Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornielsen, and you are listening to the web version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Judith Martinez. She is an assistant professor of modern and classical languages here at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Judith.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, Judith, you were on the Coders Grant with me and a bunch of other people, and this grant's goal is to integrate STEM and literacy and some other things, coding especially, into elementary schools. But your own background is a little interesting, so why don't you kind of lead us through this background and how you got to the arrival of comparative literature?
Yes, I have a background in foreign language teaching in education, and I also have a law degree. I have my master's in education here in foreign language teaching, and then I also have a PhD in comparative literature and cultural studies.
Now, when you think about that comparative literature, and you're talking to students, and you're making your sell, you're making your pitch, whatever it is, you find a promising student, and you think, you know, I would like to sell them on this kind of study, maybe as a major, or maybe just as an interest. What kinds of things do you say to them to get them interested in literature and comparative literature?
Right. Of course, you know, I'm super biased because to me, literature is a way of living. To me, literature is a space for political resistance, is a space, is escape from the world. Also, it is a way where you can, it is a space where you can create. So it is kind of like a refuge. So to me, it's also, you know, being from Latin America, it's also a way to speak up. So, you know, a lot of people ask me, how are you a lawyer? How did you, you know, do you miss being a lawyer? And then now you're into literature. And to me, that's the same. It's literature and creativity. It's advocacy because you're speaking up.
So before we move on to talking about how you convince students that it's going to help them, let's go back a step. Have you noticed, so if you think about literature, for example, and you know I happen to be interested in it also, and you think to, let's say, the heyday of either pre-Soviet Russia or other places, and in Soviet Russia also, and some other issues, people really respected and also feared literature. So people in positions of power regularly censored literature. They basically either pushed it down or exiled people that wrote. And so talk about that. Talk about literature's role over the years, for hundreds of years, as a tool that people could use to actually exposit ideas.
Right. I'm going to talk about that and I'm going to focus in Latin America because it was the same way,
sure.
Right? In Latin America,
sure.
Literature for the longest time was a political, it would issue a political stand and you know, politicians or institutions would expect that literature would be against the status quo, right? And I think right now, with everything changing in the world and economy, I think the role of literature has also, unfortunately, shifted to that, in a way, co-belonging with the system. So it really can't really survive if it's not part of the system as well. I mean, literature has to sell, you know?
Sure,
so
sure.
When you asked me the first question, how do you sell the program? I immediately thought about the word selling.
Sure.
You know, because for me, literature shouldn't be selling. It should be, you know, and I'm thinking of doing it, right? I mean, learning just for the sake of learning.
Right.
It should be just, you know, for the sake of art. You know, I'm
right.
Thinking as an artist. But I think literature right now, it's definitely, and we are aware, and I think there are many novels that are aware of this, that it's going through this phase of having to be in this co-belonging space where they have to play it within the system so that we can survive.
You know, that's interesting because one thing that I've really hated seeing is that at one time, now, of course, some of the notions we have of great writers, especially in the U.S. and growing up as I did in the 60s and 70s, was foisted on people by English teachers who sort of champion certain writers. But at the same time, I watch a lot of old YouTube clips of various television shows and early kinds of documentaries, and writers could still be really respected. If you look at in the 50s and 60s, people that were, let's say, celebrities, and I'm not talking minor celebrities, I'm talking major celebrities, whether it's Hemingway or Norman Mailer or Gore Vidal or other kinds of people, they were brought onto shows, not just political shows, but talk shows, right, where people would talk to them about their latest book and about their views on things. And with the plethora of opportunity to see that on the web that you would have now, it seems to me that writers are actually taken less seriously than they once were. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think it is true, especially with social media and, you know, the words that we have as influencers and where people get information. I think we are losing that for different reasons, right? You know, with my own kids and with my students, reading to me and getting, you know, challenged by completely different ideas and being exposed to just a completely different point of view, a completely different time in history. I think that's, what makes them uncomfortable, what, you know, pushes them to some motion, right? And I think that's what we should be looking for. But I think, you know, with the fast world, as in the sense of, you know, fast food and in the sense of fast information and in the sense of, you know, whatever is fast, you know, ways of thinking that a lot of, you know, the influence or fake influences provide, you know, in social media. I think that's, of course, you have to be really picky and have a lot of discernment so that you don't feel yourself, especially, you know, with all this fast world, right. You know, so I think you have to be right now, and especially as a literature professor, I think you have to be really intentional in inspiring students so that, you know, they seek literature and they seek these other ways of mentality, so that even though it makes you uncomfortable as you're reading, or it, you know, is not, I have a lot of students who say, well, you know, it's switching back and forth into time. Well, yes, you know, but this patterns that, you know, that your brain goes through when you're reading, I think that's what we should be craving.
Right.
But we're getting so used to this fast.
No, I understand. Of, you know, I mean, and of course it's easy to devolve into standing on your front porch with a cane and yelling at kids to get out of your yard. And I don't want it to be that, where people are always saying back in the old days. But
yeah.
But the one thing is, so talk about that then. So let's take the word sellout, ha-ha. But let's take that word out, and let's talk about it's still going to, you have to convince students that it has value, that it brings value to them. Doesn't have to be dollars necessarily. So when you're talking to a promising student, what do you say? How do you convince them? I mean, I've had a lot of personal conversations, one-on-ones with students in my office, where I give them a wide array of opinions about not just physics, but about other things that I think will have value in their lives. So what will you say?
Yeah, honestly, the best way for me to convince them is when they are already in the classroom taking a language class, and I introduce a poem, or, they're taking a class that it's a gen ed in languages, and then I introduce a short reading, you know, and then when they see that is still relevant, and when they see that literature still, you know, they can compare it to their own life, and they can see themselves, or they can understand a little bit and go beyond, and when they can taste that joy, right? When they can taste that how it feels to be inside a different world, where they can taste, you know, how it feels, what the character, for instance, might be feeling, or what the reading and the words are telling them, in this, you know, when they can feel a concrete something in an abstract way, if I'm making
right.
sense,
sure.
And I think that taste, it's addictive. You know, and when I can give them a little bit of that, then I can, you know, then they can relate. Because students, you know, just by nature, want to, you know, learn just the unknown. They want to go into that journey. They just need us to show them, you know, this is an amazing work of art. You know, this is what we have. And once they taste it, you know, then they want to have and go on and read more, and then, you know, and then they follow you around. What, you know, what's next? What do I read next? And, you know, that's my biggest satisfaction. But I think that rather than selling it out, it's, you know, when you're talking about a character, when you're talking about a novel, when you're talking about a poem or any text, and they see that it doesn't matter when it was written, that it's still relevant, then they can also understand the value, right? They can immediately see the difference between this is a work of art and this isn't, because they can still see the relevance in today's world. They can see it in their, they can see how it's still making an impact and making a change. They can see the impact of words right now. And I think once they see that, because they want to change the world just as natural learners that they are, then you can see their eyes, and then they want more. And then I'm not selling it, I'm just sharing it.
Oh, that's a good one. So now let's talk about STEM. You're one of the people on STEM. This grant has a team that's something like 8 faculty and a bunch of grad students and staff and so forth. And there's people from a lot of different areas. Your background is law, education, and Spanish, and literature, and you're being brought in to help us, and we have a goal, and we think we know what the goal is, but we're not sure exactly. So talk about how you see the goal that we have, how it ties into STEM, what you've learned so far, and the things that are different than what you learned so far.
Right. I think, you know, that hanging out with all of these faculty from different backgrounds, first of all, I have learned that we often think that, you know, especially because we're in different buildings and we only see each other in committees, but, you know, now it's I have found that we have a lot more in common than we think, right? And you know, especially with literature and just the way I see things, naturally, coding is a lot similar to creating a work of art, to analyzing a work of art, to deconstructing a work of art. And a lot of the times we don't think about it, right? But when you're coding, and I'm not a coder, right? I'm just a learner in the team, in that side. But I am delighted to see all of those similarities, right? One of the things that I have noticed, for instance, is that, you know, the way the metacognitive approach when you are creating something, you're taking notes, you're doing the failing, and then the, you know, try again when you're experimenting with something. And that's kind of what you do when you're creating or when you're interpreting something. You're just bouncing ideas and then taking notes and seeing what works and what doesn't work until it works. Right. And when we're coding and when we're trying experiments in the workshops that I have attended so far that we're creating for the teachers, I mean, coding it's has to do with logical thinking, and that's what literature is, right? It's logical thinking, but it is also looking for patterns, deconstructing those patterns, creating more, having. Once you master, then you feel ready to make these twists around what you're creating or understand the twists that are coming. It's about predicting too. So all of these things have to do with writing. They have to do with reading. They have to do with comprehension. So, you know, to me, in the teacher in me, in the classroom, right, this is something that goes together rather than language art and STEM. Right? This is something that really goes together.
Well, as a person, I don't like to say scientist, but I guess it's fair. As a physicist, it always has burned me a little bit that people think, well, you know, anybody that knows me knows that Big Bang Theory, and I don't view that positively because it casts so many scientists as strange, otherworldly creatures who do bizarre stuff. But in fact, they're driven by the same kinds of things and that the amount of creativity that goes into a physics lab is actually quite high. We build things. We build things from our own ideas. We think of things to try to tease out information that we think is hidden in the world. So, I mean, there's a high level of creativity in it. So when we write, and of course every physicist or every scientist knows that in order to communicate with other people, which is the essence of all of this. If you do something in your own lab and never communicate it, it's not particularly useful to anybody. Then in communicating it, we have to learn how to do that as well. So So what kinds of things do you think that if we try to integrate this better, people will gain? Whereas right now, people will think you got the language arts and then you do your science over here. So what kinds of things are we going to try to do?
Right. I think that integrating it, you know, it's first of all, it's breaking this myth that they go separately, right? That STEM and language art are two different, that they, you know, they are different things, but they have a lot of things in common and they will help each other, right? In as you learn them. So, you know, I think that when you are learning logical thinking, when you're learning computational sciences or computing sciences, when you're learning to understand how things or predicting things, this will help you in both in writing as well, right? When you are when you're free writing, where you're when you're creating, when you're analyzing anything in the classroom with the students. I mean, it'll logical thinking and constructing and deconstructing. I just, you know, I guess I have been, now that you're talking about sellout, I think you have, you know, I have become one of you in a way, because I don't, it's hard now for me to see them as a separate thing, right? When I'm taking a workshop and you're creating this character in the computer and giving them orders and then trying, and then you stop and take notes and see what it did, and then you're predicting what it's going to do, and then you give it an order. To me, I'm seeing it as, this is how I create a character in a novel, right? Or when I'm predicting what the character is going to do in, and I'm reading something, and then I start writing, and then I read, you know, there's a lot of metacognition going on there, right? So, you know, I'm thinking about my own thinking, and I'm thinking about my own learning, and I'm thinking about my own writing, and I'm thinking about my own creativity. But the main thing is that I am also, you know, seeing myself as a creator. Right. And I think that when I can create, we're planting that seed in the students that they can do something that can lead them to change something in their environment. Because you see coding and you see computers everywhere, right, in the world. And, you know, and they, and when you're reading, also you see the world in the text, right? It is a reflection in a way or another, realistic, surrealist, or whatever, of the world. And, you know, but you also see a little bit of the care of the author. And I think that when students can go through that metacognitive process that we're trying to build when they write about what they're learning, and when they think about what they're learning and how, you know, and the process itself of learning, we're planting that seed that they can be the authors of what they create.
That's a good point, because when I said sellout earlier, I was also referring to the Americanized version of that, which means that you've gone away from what's good and gone to what's bad. Mm-hmm. So for older Americans, a classic version of that would when Bob Dylan plugged in and went electric at the Newport Festival and played Like a Rolling Stone. Many of the Blowing in the Wind fans basically called him flat out a sellout, because they said all he was pursuing now was the world's riches and things like that, instead of trying to be a poet or whatever. And one of the things we have with students is they worry, I believe, some of them, that we could conceivably get into STEM, that by leaving the arts and leaving the creative field that they think they're leaving behind, they're entering a field where they become part of the system, and therefore they are indeed themselves selling out. But what we try to communicate to them is there is a inherent beauty and a creativity in STEM, just like there is in writing your own stories.
Right, right. I agree with that. And of course, you know, and I understand the production and you know, and the how you distribute the products and all of that, and we could get into that and everything, right? But I think that, you know, that's why we're trying to build both things, because you know, and then it would go back to the public affairs and being an ethical leader. I think that as teachers, you know, we also try to teach our students about, you know, our cultural competence, ethical leadership, being
right,
fair. And I think that's something that we're going to pass on to them. also, you know, not only the learning of the STEM, not only the learning of the languages and creation and, you know, we are talking about, you know, like we said at the beginning, just learning because we want to share knowledge with them and they see that. And I think, you know, when you talk about the word advocate, I mean, lawyer, right, and my background, and the advocacy of it, because
right.
the word in Spanish is, you know, to advocate. I think that students, you know, the main goal when you create is to advocate, it's to connect, is to build bridges, right? And
let's talk about that a little bit, because let's tie up at the end with, you've got a background and some experience with one of the things that parts of STEM struggle with. So computer science, in some ways, physics in a lot of ways, and a few other of the hard, what they consider the hard technical sciences, struggle with underrepresentation.
Mm-hmm.
And you've spent some time thinking about those kinds of things. What is it? What kinds of things can be done? What kinds of things should we be doing? We always agonize over this, and it's not really clear to us ever what we can do. Have you looked into that sort of thing, just bringing underrepresented groups mm-hmm. into learning environments in general?
Right, into learning environments in general, you know, and then, of course, into STEM, too. You know, I think it's breaking, and we've been saying that, but it's deconstructing. You know, we have these ideas and just... that we believe because of, you know, the way we were raised or because of the way, you know, we see the world and because of whatever. But I, you know, I would speak as a female, you know. For me, getting a PhD was difficult because I am a female from the Latinx culture. And there wasn't a lot of representation. And, you know, people ask me a lot of questions. Well, why would you want to do that? You know, you're already married, you know. So I think, you
good.
Know, breaking a myth. And I think, you know, even though students, we don't tell them, hey, you know, I think you know, one of the things that we're doing in this project is bringing pre-service teachers into the classroom, right? Females will be there. You know, students that are first-generation students in Missouri State. I think those role models will be key to break those patterns, to break those myths that, you know, that higher education isn't something that they want to pursue. I think those students, our Missouri State students, when they step into the classroom, you know, they don't know this, but they're changing their lives just by being role models, just by being ambassadors, because, you know, they're motivating these kids. They're seeing that, you know, it is just what's next to go to college. You know, it is just what we're going to be doing. You know, I want to be like that kid who sat with me and worked on this battery project when I was in the classroom. And, you know, that's what I want to be. Right. It's not something that now looks like something that's far away from them. We're bringing, you know, higher education to them. And this is also, you know, beyond STEM and beyond the literature and beyond the writing. I mean, we're just bringing higher education to them
right.
in the classroom. And I, you know, to me as a younger student, that would be something very meaningful and to do hands-on things with them. That's what students will remember. And you know, and besides, you know, seeing people from underrepresented backgrounds, females, or, you know, to me this is something that, you know, my heart is in there. I think that we need to, you know, do a bigger job. When you ask me what else do we need to be doing? I think we need to be intentional, and I think that's part of this. You know, we're seeking out resources so that we can build something sustainable, so we can, you know, go into the classroom, help the teachers, walk hand in hand with them, bring students so they can work with younger students, so that the full cycle or the full
yes.
circle it's completed. And that, you know, this is something that then it'll be what's going to be natural for them. They're going to create something so that they can be the next generation of leaders using education, which is really what they're gonna, you know, what you keep intrinsically in your life.
That's of course always a worry, because sustainability is one of the issues behind these grants. But everybody knows that once the money runs out and the university faculty have to move on to new things, how does the thing sustain itself? If you've tried to give some sort of a change, a sea change in the way things are being done, and so without the cycle, without getting other people engaged, for whom this becomes part of their own lives, it's doomed, ultimately.
Yeah, teachers, I think, you know, to me, are the most valuable resource here.
I agree.
Because they're the ones that are going to continue with the legacy.
Yes.
You know, they're the ones who are, you know, going to continue with the passion. They're the ones who are going to have the vision. And they're the ones who are going to inherit this to younger generations. So the biggest, you know, I see myself, or my role here is more of a recruiter of teachers of rural areas so that they can come and join this program. But, you know, more than a recruiter, I want to be somebody that shares this idea, this vision with them. You know, I like that, sharing the vision more than recruiting, you know, because we're sharing that passion. And you know, I want us to have the same goal, that same objective, that, you know, that same desire and passion to want to change the lives of the kids. And I think every teacher does. You know, I think that's something that we all have in common with the K-12 teachers. And you know, rather than recruiting, I want them to know that we have something to offer them, that we're gonna work hand in hand with them, but that we share the same vision and that we understand because we've been in the classroom, you know, and we wanna work with them because we know that as teachers, we often like resources or help, or, you know, we have too much going on. But if we work together, then this becomes sustainable.
Let's hope that is indeed the case. Well, Judith, I hate to say it, but it's gone on a good long time, and we are going to let you go. Thanks so much for stopping by today.
Thank you.
And once again, this is Dave Cornielsen for STEM Spots, the web version, signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.